This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We are talking libraries and books today, those special spaces and beloved tomes that you can find in every Massachusetts city and town. Later in the hour, we'll bring you two friends who set out to visit every library in the Commonwealth. We'll hear about a project to put libraries in prisons and talk spring book recommendations with two local booksellers. But first, we've had protests in libraries on our minds after anti-mask demonstrations last month in Boston Public Library branches. And it got us to thinking about the promise of a library, whether it should offer patrons and kids safe or sacred spaces. So we decided to ask a school librarian.
It's lunchtime, so I allow students to come in and eat their lunch here. So there are students here eating lunch. There are others doing some work, others who take virtual high school classes. Yeah, it's always an active space.
That is Anita Salucci, the librarian at Westboro High School, talking with us from work at lunchtime today. Salucci is also the K-12 library department head there and has written about libraries as safe spaces for kids. We spoke this afternoon, and I started by asking her what she thought when she first heard about last month's protests.
Yeah, it was really interesting because of everything that's going on throughout the country right now in school libraries with book challenges and banning some books in schools and such, I actually wasn't that surprised. It makes sense that public libraries are also going to be subjected to some of this fear-based protesting as well. I think that, you know, librarians work hard to create a space that's welcoming and safe for everyone. And unfortunately, some people may not always agree what that actually ends up looking like.
So let's stay in that for a minute, because I think what struck me, Anita, in her first hearing the news was this idea that libraries are supposed to be a safe space. You know, I personally love libraries. For me, they're almost a sacred kind of space. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about that and whether that means, you know, there's a particular claim to what does and doesn't happen in a library.
Sure. So I truly believe that the school library should be a space where all feel a sense of solace, so a general overall sense of well-being and safety. And most school libraries are now active learning spaces, but also offer our vulnerable students a refuge in a variety of ways.
Let me just stop you there. At one level, I understand what you're saying. And at another level, I wonder if you can personify that for us. Take a young person and tell me, what is the young person's experience in the library? Maybe somebody specific, obviously without using their name, that you're thinking of for whom the library serves those functions.
Yes. So I think of students who may have some vulnerabilities in their life. So whether it's they're living in an experience of homelessness or poverty, or, you know, there's challenges at home, and this space offers them a place to come in and breathe and really just escape from some of the, you know, the nonstop movement in life. I think that, you know, we have an opportunity as librarians to have our programming work in such a way that we are thinking about those students and the gaps and the equity issues that we experience in our culture. So I think that, you know, that student comes into this space and sees representation of themselves, whether it's in a piece of artwork or it's a book display, or it's just that smiling face of the librarian who's willing to say hello to them. It might be the only person who has smiled at them that day.
So that really, Anita, brings it home, right? That sense of this is for me. I belong here. I can see myself here. And you're really rooted in school libraries. I know you've done partnership work with the public library in your community as well. Is it and should it be the same expectation for a public library, for a whole community? Should we expect those same things from our public libraries?
Yeah, I do think we should. I think that, you know, I think libraries historically have been places where we think about what's happening in our society and, you know, through the years have been places that have supported whatever inequities exist in our culture. So yes, I do think that we should expect that in our public libraries as well.
Anita, what do you love most about a good library? Is it a corner of the library, a sight, a smell, a display? What do you love most?
I think it's the whole experience. I don't know if I could just pinpoint one thing. I really do think it goes back to that whole idea of that solace, just that calming feeling of walking into that space and knowing that whether it's public or school, knowing that if there's something I'm curious about, or, you know, I just want to sit and read, that I'm able to do that. And that if I need help to do so, there's someone there that'll do that for me. Or even if it's a community meeting space, that it just offers that opportunity to view the community in a different way.
What's your oldest childhood memory of a library?
When I was a child, I used to walk to the library every day after school, the public library. And it was a little tiny library. I think it was like at the bottom of a house. And you walked down these three steps to get into the main area of the library. And, you know, it was all those things that you just asked. It was the smell. It was the look. It was just the excitement of being independent and going there myself at like 8, 9, 10 years old. And, you know, being able to wander through that space and find something that caught my curiosity, and not having to explain it. I think that's, you know, that I would just remember that feeling so deeply.
That last part really registers with me, that not having to explain it, you know, for a kid to be free to have your own interests and preferences, set them for yourself and not have to explain them or justify them to anybody. That really is the realm of a kid's growing intellectual curiosity, isn't it?
Absolutely, for sure.
So I think the last place I want to go with you, I think about the fact that a library is a place that the community owns. Right? If it's a school, then the school community owns the library. If it's a city or town, the town community owns it. And this tension of creating a safe space versus creating a safe space for speech and discord and disagreement. You know, you've made reference to book bannings or book protests. We talked about the anti-mask protests in the Boston Public Library branches. How do you balance claims from a community to be able to do all of that in a space like a library? And is it right to try to balance all of that?
Yeah, I think it's a very careful balance, but I also think it's one that, you know, is not a solo balance. So it should be, you know, you mentioned that I work with other entities in the town. So I'm always pulling in other people to have these conversations. So I think it should be community-based in the sense of, you know, how are we reacting to what's happening in our communities, and how can we react? So I think that's a complex question. I think it's also a little different for different communities, but I do think it is something that libraries should wrestle with and should have discourse about, and, you know, be able to, you know, whether it's hosting forums or just ensuring that there is a way to open that communication.
Will we always have libraries?
Yes.
And the library tomorrow that you dream of, what is it doing? What is it like?
Well, first of all, I dream that there is a physical school library in every school, a certified school library teacher in every school library. I think that is my biggest dream. Currently, we have a lot of inequity across the Commonwealth with that. So my biggest dream is that everyone, every child gets to experience all that we're talking about and grows up to understand the complexity and the necessity of having this free discourse and a space and people who protect the right to read and the freedom for information.
Anita Salucci is the librarian at Westboro High School and the K-12 library department head there. Anita, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
We are loving on libraries this hour. Before the break, we talked about protests in libraries and libraries as safe or sacred spaces. Now we want to catch up with a project that we first brought you in the before times, before COVID. June of 2019, we sat down with two local men who were on a quest to visit every library in Massachusetts.
So we have a Google map. We rely on all things Google. And when the map turns all orange, I'll know we're done.
These guys love libraries, and their quest gave them a firsthand look at how libraries are and sometimes aren't adapting to be essential to cities and towns. Fast forward through a global pandemic, we wanted to check in with them now, compare how it started and how it's going, both for them and for libraries. And we'd love to hear from you. Do you have a favorite library memory or experience, a library you've always loved to visit? What does your local library mean to you? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So back with us on the line, Adam Zand and Greg Peveril-Conti, co-founders of Libraryland and also the PR agency Sharp Orange. Greg and Adam, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having us again.
It's great to have you.
So yeah, thanks.
It's great. So we are going to turn to your work in a moment, but I know the two of you took the time to listen to the conversation we had before the break about what the promise of a library is. Is it a safe space? What about protest and discord? I'd love to hear a quick reaction from each of you. Greg?
Sure. I mean, we often talk about public libraries as the one civic space that's open to everyone, and that's a really great ideal. But we know there are people who don't always feel welcome to public libraries. And that's something that needs to be recognized, acknowledged, and addressed. But we do feel that libraries have the potential for being that space. The issue of protests at libraries is super concerning. I actually saw it firsthand this past summer at the Greenfield Public Library, where a ribbon cutting was interrupted by protesters, hoping that people would find the fraud behind the new library. Very disturbing.
And Adam, is it a place for speech like that, or is it first and foremost a safe space of some kind?
Well, thankfully, that speech was far away from the indoors of the library, which is typically a little quieter. I would echo Greg when he's talking about public institutions that everybody theoretically has access to. You know, we started our PR agency in a public library. We had a study room. We had great Wi-Fi. We had free parking. And we came out of there saying, this has been awesome. Let's keep on going to libraries. There's no reason to go to WeWorks. There's no reason to work from home. So, I mean, we always feel welcomed. And I can't imagine, you know, the scenario when you're talking about public institutions, a more welcoming institution than a public library.
Perfect place to then pick it up on your quest. Greg, you set out to visit and rate all the 400-plus libraries in Massachusetts. And we talked to you sort of during that process, but then COVID hit. So what's changed?
Yeah, well, our travels were radically curtailed in 2020. You know, in 2019, we went to more than 250 public libraries. And in 2020, we went to fewer than 50. It was a real shock to our systems. The good news is that we're now up to over 280 libraries here in the state. And we're continuing our travels. During the pandemic, we were able to see the beautiful new Tufts Library in Weymouth. We were able to see the Norwell Library before it opened with the architects behind that, Odin Zello.
Greg. So we also went to the Medford Public Library. That was delayed opening. Same footprint as an old 1950s building, but just amazing energy in that place. We went to Littleton, Mass., the Reuben Hoare Library, and met up with an old social media marketing friend of mine. Did a tour. Just what a wonderful view, looking off a back reading area. Huge kids room on a reading porch, and an energy and excitement about both of those institutions and also the Tufts and Weymouth that Greg talked about that was sort of in the heat of COVID. You know, thankfully the Littleton and Medford openings were more open, and we had a great time at all of those.
So those are fantastic examples, and you're inspiring our listeners. So I am going to grab a couple of calls here, 800-423-8255. Amy's on the line in Fitchburg with a library memory. Amy, go ahead.
Yeah, I grew up right not far from Littleton, actually, in Shirley, really small town, and I was able to walk to the town library from my middle school, and I just always remember this big old red big brick building. It's now a residence, and there's one that's similarly built in Bolton, I believe, similar structure. But I always remember walking up, and it had the smallest doorknob on the screen door to walk in. And I just remember the smell. I love the smell of old libraries. And Shirley has since built a new library. It just doesn't have that smell. But in the basement of this, the children's room. Yeah, eventually, right? But they had this children's room down in the basement of the library, and it had a big red safe in it. And somebody had lost the combination years before, so it was always a challenge for all the kids to try to open the safe, and everybody wondering what kind of treasure it was in there. And I don't know if they ever opened it before they sold it as a residence, but it was always so fun to go down there and try the combination and see if we could open it.
Love it, Amy. Thank you. We'll take one more. We've got Melanie in Newton. Melanie, go ahead.
Hi. I'm going to talk about an expanded service that the Library of Newton offers to all shut-ins, and by this, my personal example is my husband, who suffered a stroke during surgery at age 58, 11 years ago. And the library service is you go online, he searches for the books he wants, and within a few days or weeks, a volunteer comes by and gives him the books or movies with a smile, and then there's a pickup a few weeks later, and there's an ongoing relationship.
Melanie, thank you. I'm sorry that happened for your husband, and I'm so happy to hear that you're getting that support from your community. Greg, I want to come back, and I want to notice that Melanie referred to the volunteer and the smile, too. This is neighborhood. This is community. In all of your travels through libraries, what have you learned is important about what they do in communities?
Oh, man. They do so much for their communities. We've seen in our travels, we were at a library. It's not in Massachusetts. It's in Wichita, Kansas. But we were meeting with a librarian there who said they had 300 or 400 people a day coming into the library specifically to use computers to access government services and benefits during the pandemic. That's an essential role. These are people who may not have had broadband at home or the technology they needed. The library was there for them. We have seen the same thing. The outreach services that the caller just described are fantastic, but we're seeing libraries find new ways to get resources out to their communities. I was actually talking with Nikki Wolf at the Morris Institute of Natick today, where they put curbside pickup boxes outside, and she said this is all about knowing the patrons at their point of need, and I think that's what libraries are really excellent at doing. Learning the needs of their community and finding ways to meet patrons there.
So those are two great examples. Adam, I'll turn to you as well and sort of ask for a pivot that you've seen. You said more than 200 libraries before the pandemic and then libraries during the pandemic. Some other kind of magnificent pivot that you've seen a library make in the Commonwealth during
Sure.
the pandemic.
Well, a lot of libraries have pivoted on programming. So in the past, we'd come into a library for story time or for kind of group projects and crafts projects. And obviously with the pandemic, that wasn't possible, but libraries adapted really quickly, just like we all did to Zoom. They figured it out. And they came up with safe spaces and interactive ways to connect with their communities. Very early in the pandemic, I did a yoga class that was delivered by the Watertown Public Library. And it was really fun. You know, I was missing my yoga class locally at the Y. I logged in and I got on the class. I think similarly, and we'll sort of get to it, but coming out of the pandemic, we're sort of hoping that online programming is in addition to the in-person. I mean, obviously, you know, we've gotten used to it. You can do some pretty creative things online. So those would be a couple of examples that I've enjoyed, and totally echoing Greg. I think a library is best when they just ask their community what they want. And a lot of time you'll walk into a library and there's unmet needs. You didn't even know you wanted. I went into a library in Nebraska, and I'd recently moved to Lancaster, Massachusetts, and I didn't know much about the community. There was a genealogy section in this library, and I asked, do you have any books that I might be able to learn about Lancaster, Massachusetts? So here I am in another part of the world looking at two original books that give all the history of Lancaster you could ever want. And I didn't know that when I went in. I also looked up my grandfather, like his papers, sorry, my great-grandfather, when he traveled from Europe, over 100 years ago. And I was able to call that up within 5 minutes on an interactive monitor at that Nebraska library.
It's really kind of amazing, Greg, to hear Adam tell this story about learning about his home here, right? And his family and his history here, way over there. And Adam, you've set us up then to spend a minute talking about what is next for libraries. And again, with the two of you, Greg, having seen nearly 300 now here in Massachusetts, I got to get a sense that is past, present, and sneak previews of future. So what else is a sneak preview of the future, Greg, for libraries here?
I think that libraries are becoming more essential than ever, and I think there's a few reasons for that. One is making space and recognizing the needs of marginalized communities and groups and individuals, and meeting the needs of those people even under duress, as your first guest alluded to. We're also seeing libraries playing a role in bridging between different groups and communities. There's a really active group of bridging organizations out there, things like America Talks, things like the American Exchange Program, and libraries can play a role as a place to bring those conversations together. And then libraries also, I think more than ever, are a source of trusted information, a shared pool of information available to all of us. As more things move online, having the literacy skills, not language literacy, but information literacy skills, to make sense of the information and put that information to work, that's going to be a future role of the library that's going to be really important for all of us.
All right. That is Greg Peveril-Conti and Adam Zand, co-founders of Libraryland and also the PR agency Sharp Orange, which they formed in a library. Greg, Adam, thanks so much for being with us.
Tiziana, we have a question for you, Tiziana.
Jump on in. Go for it. Go ahead. Go for it.
So do you have a favorite library memory that you want to share with the audience today?
Oh, I love it that you turned it back on me. Yes. So my godmother, Carol Collins, and local mom, Claire Ott, ran our public library, and it was the summer book program where I first read books like The Chronicles of Narnia and The Secret Garden, and it was my magic, special fantasy place where I could just go be me. I appreciate you both asking and visiting with us today. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having us.
What a delight.
Yeah, we love this show. Thanks so much. We'll catch in when we finish up the 400-plus library.
Let's plan on it. We've been having a library hour on the show here today, and that means books. And there is a lot to love about books. Just ask Rory Gilmore.
Are you seeing the books? Everything you would want to read is right here. Feel it. Feels good, right? Now smell it. Nothing smells like that.
Alexis Bledel there is Gilmore girl Rory in the Yale Library. So now we want to finish the show with books, but with another way to get your hands on great ones, and great smelling ones too, which is your local bookstore. We are talking about book recommendations now, whether it's maybe poolside for spring break or fireside as we try to outlast winter. What books are you reading right now? Anything you'd like to recommend, or maybe something you're looking forward to? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can email us at radioboston@gmail.com or tweet us at Radio Boston. We've got two booksellers joining us now to share some suggestions. Catherine Nazzaro is manager and bookseller at Porter Square Books in Cambridge and Boston, and Caroline Harvey is co-owner of Dogtown Books in Gloucester. Catherine, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And Caroline, welcome to you as well.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much.
So, Caroline, what is the book that you cannot put down right now?
The one I can't put down right now Well, I'll tell you that I am desperately awaiting a book that just came out on Tuesday called Bless the Daughter Raised by a Voice in Her Head. It's a full-length poetry collection by Warson Shire, who most people might know because she collaborated with Beyoncé on Lemonade.
Oh, wow. So it's a book that you will not be able to put down when it comes.
I tell you, I can't stop checking my email to find out when it will be delivered.
And Catherine,
I am not excited.
Catherine, what about you? The book you can't put down right now.
I'm also super excited for the Warson Shire book. I read a few poems from it and it's amazing. But for me, the book I can't put down right now is Kaiki by Vaishnavi Patel. It comes out in April from Orbit Books, and it's a retelling of the Ramayana along the lines of Circe, where it takes like a female villain in the story and just gives her point of view of everything. And it's like a 500-page epic story, and I'm 2/3 of the way through it and cannot put it down. It's so wonderful.
So I want to talk a little bit about your stores. Caroline, you're new to the show. Tell us a little bit about Dogtown Books.
Thanks. So my husband Lucas and I bought Dogtown Books just at the beginning of 2019. It is a used bookstore specializing in the used and unusual. It's been around since 1997, and we purchased it from one of the original owners. It is, in thinking about that little clip you played about the smell of books, it is definitely a traditional used bookstore with creaky wooden floors and that great smell of used books, lots of objects to touch and hold. We have some antique books in our glass cases, which we keep open so that people can take a look at these old books with gorgeous leather and suede covers. And we also have, we keep true to the used and unusual. So we focus on a lot of local history, books that were underrepresented. And of course, similar to our friends at Portrait Square Books, we keep our marginalized and underrepresented communities up front and center.
So, Catherine, there's a lot of description there from Caroline. I have noticed that throughout this hour, it's the tactile experience as well, the physical experience of being around books, the smell of books. In a new bookstore, where do you think the big piece of magic comes for someone when they walk in?
I think in a new bookstore, part of the magic is just like any space that has a lot of books in it feels magical. Each book is its own possibility, and so you get all of them together and you're surrounded by infinite possibilities. And so, like, coming through, one of my favorite things about working at a bookstore is seeing people come into the store and see their favorite books that, like, they own and they've read before 100 times. I've seen people, like, lovingly stroke the spine. I've seen people jump up and down and, like, clap a little, and it's all by themselves, but it's like seeing an old friend again.
So 1-800-423-8255 to tell us the book that is your old friend. And I do also want to give a chance to introduce our listeners to some new friends. So let's talk about the list you brought. And I do want to say we've got the full set of your lists on our website at radioboston.org. Folks, you'll be able to go there to look it all up. Caroline, one new friend you'd like to recommend to our listeners today?
Well, I'll start with a book that really does for me feel like a friend. It's a book I've read cover to cover twice, but it's the book I carry with me. Even if I don't think I'll have a chance to read it, it gets packed with me and carried around. And that is a book called Toil and Trouble by Augustine Burroughs. It came out in 2019, and I've recommended it to everyone. If you know Augustine's work, he wrote Running with Scissors and a memoir called Dry. He is a very funny writer and tends to weave memoirs around some tragic and deeply poignant legacies of mental illness in his family. This book, Toil and Trouble, it centers around a through line of what Augustine calls being a witch and his understanding of the supernatural and almost science fiction occurrences that happen in his real life. And he begins to open up this angle of looking at the legacy of family and love and the way we create our own families with this idea of openness to the mystic in a way that is so real and so funny and so appealing to anyone with a little bit of cynicism. He starts the book by talking about what he doesn't believe in. And then kind of reluctantly and hilariously admits that kind of against his own will, he is in fact a witch. And the book takes place where they Augustine and his husband and their pack of wily dogs are moving out of New York City, which is this huge moment of change and grief and the unknown. And they move to a more rural landscape where they have a bunch of land. And
So let's stop it there. Not that I mean, it's fascinating, but A, I don't want to give too much away. And B, I want to make room for some other recommendations. But again, that is Toil and Trouble by Augustine Burroughs. Yes.
Yes. And you can tell it's like my best friend. I can't stop talking about it. So I mean, that's what makes me off.
No, that's okay. And thanks for being good about it. But that is what makes a book fantastic when you just want everybody to know. So that book you're going to put on the list, Catherine.
So for me, it's going to be Act Your Age, Eve Brown by Talia Hibbert, which is the third in the Brown Sisters series, which is a series of romance novels. For me, romance novels are like the ultimate old friend books, because even if the story is different, romance novels follow a very specific like guideline. You have the get together, you have like about 2/3 of the way through, you have a turn, you have a definite happy ending. So even when you're looking at a new book, it's always, you know what you're expecting, which I feel is very comforting. I sped through this series, and this specific one is about Eve, who is the youngest daughter, and has always kind of been treated like a baby. She's in her mid-20s and decides that it is time for her to get her act together and like grow up a little bit. And she starts working at a bed and breakfast after she hit the owner with her car. And it is about the two of them developing a relationship. And because it's the third book in the series, the first two being about her other two sisters, you get a lot of the old characters coming back. And it's like seeing your old friends and seeing how those relationships have developed into them being a part of the family.
So that's Act Your Age, Eve Brown by Talia Hibbert, yes?
Yes.
All right. We've got a couple callers who'd like to make recommendations. Megan's on the line in Duxbury. Go ahead, Megan.
Hi, Tiziana. I have a book I'm totally obsessed with, and just had it, gave it to my whole book group, and they all were too. It's called Why Fish Don't Exist by Lulu Miller. Maybe your speakers have heard of it. It's a nonfiction read by, she actually works at NPR Invisibilia program, and it is a brilliant short read that packs a punch and a surprise and a twist and a turn. I can't recommend it enough.
Fantastic, Megan. Thank you so much. Have either of you happened to have heard of it, Catherine or Caroline?
I've definitely heard of, I haven't read it yet, but it is one of the books that, like, when it first came out, everybody wanted to be reading that book. It's definitely high on a lot of people's lists.
Fantastic. All right. Ben, quickly in Cambridge. Ben, what's your recommendation?
Hi, Tiziana. I love anything by John Bellairs. So he was a wonderful children's book author. He wrote a couple adult novels as well. But to tie both parts of your second together, I used to, in second grade, go to the library in school to check to see if there were any new John Bellairs books on the shelves. And he had 3 different series for kids, all of them wonderful, usually a child who befriends an older adult. And there's a lot of mystery and occult involved, and they're just delightful, warm, friendly stories. So those were some of my best friends growing up.
Wonderful. Thanks, Ben. And Caroline, I know that you also brought a YA recommendation. Maybe you can briefly tell us about that.
I can, and it's definitely YA. It is a board book, so really, you could bring this to a child as, you know, as young as 2 or 3. It's called A is for Activist by Inosanto Nagara. And it came into our store and everyone fell in love with it. Everyone picked it up. And like Catherine was saying, it was one of those books where people had a visceral reaction to it. There were facial expressions changing and hands clapping. It's a familiar device. It's an alphabet book. You know, A is for apples, B is for bananas. It rhymes. There's a lot of alliteration, but it is unapologetically progressive. And the words are, for example, A is for activist, but it's also for ally, for advocate. And it was written by the author to really fill a gap in a book that was educational and political with really layered illustrations, so you could return again and again to these words and kind of, as I said, unapologetically getting these words of social justice and civil rights into the vocabulary of young people. And it's so special.
Fantastic. All right. We have a little less than a minute left. So, Catherine, back to you. A title coming out later this year that you're looking for.
Later this year, The Hacienda by Isabel Cañas is coming out later this year. Fans of Mexican Gothic are going to love this book. It's a little Gothic novel that takes place in Mexico during the Mexican Civil War, about similar to Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca. It's about a woman who becomes the second wife of this rich man, goes to his home, and finds out that it is just incredibly haunted. One of my friends tweeted about this book, and I immediately like downloaded the advanced copy, read it immediately. It's just
fantastic.
All encompassing.
Catherine Nazzaro from Porter Square Books, Caroline Harvey of Dogtown Books in Gloucester. It's been great to have your recommendations. And again, they'll be on our website, radioboston.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
People who are incarcerated aren't obsessed with prison, they're obsessed with freedom, according to Reginald Dwayne Betts. And for him, books, and specifically poetry, was the vehicle for feeling a sense of freedom internally. And since he got out, he has dedicated his career to giving that freedom to people who are still on the inside. He's a poet, founder and director of Freedom Reads, and now a recipient of a MacArthur Genius Award. And he's got a plan to build 1,000 micro-libraries in prisons across the country. He started with a library inside the former jail cell of Malcolm X at the MCI Norfolk Correctional Facility in Norfolk, Massachusetts. He joined us back in December to talk about that project. We wanted to bring you that conversation today. I started by asking him to paint me a picture of what one of those cell libraries actually looks like.
I should start with this. MCI Norfolk was built years and years ago in the 1940s as a kind of more of a rehabilitative institution. When you go there and when you walk into the yard feels very much like a college campus. And when Malcolm X talked about it, he talked about it feeling quite different from the other facilities that he had been in. And MCI Norfolk is also famed for its law library and it's famed for its library. And I should say that we say this may have been Malcolm X's prison cell, but really it's more of a metaphorical point. Once you've been inside of a cell, they feel eerily familiar. And what I'm making a point of emphasis is not the particular location of the cell, but the life of the person who was once in that prison in one of those spaces of confinement, and how Malcolm X transformed his life through literature. And what happens is, you know, when you go into a prison cell, it is dank, it is dark, it feels so utterly unforgiving. And, you know, when you throw wood into that cell, you know, when you remove the bunks and you put something that was beautifully handcrafted and you put these specially selected 500 books that run the gamut from genre, from mystery to science fiction, to philosophy, to poetry, to drama. When you put those books on those shelves, it transforms the space and it becomes calming and it becomes a reminder of what you want to leave prison and go to and why it matters to leave that place.
There are so many questions I want to ask you based on what you just said. I think I'm going to go back to the beginning of your answer. You talked about the intention of the design at MCI Norfolk in the 1940s. And then you also said that once you've been in a prison cell, they feel familiar. You were in a number of facilities when you were incarcerated. When you went to MCI Norfolk, did it feel like they had built something different, or did it feel strangely familiar to you?
The landscape felt different. I didn't see grass when I was incarcerated. And, you know, you take something as mundane as grass, although Walt Whitman called his iconic book of America, Leaves of Grass, something as basic and fundamental and mundane as grass was non-existent for the larger part of the 8.5 years that I spent in prison. And at MCI Norfolk, they have landscaping crews. And so, you know, I have to admit that MCI Norfolk did feel different in really fundamental ways. And that's partly why it felt like the perfect place to begin, because, you know, what we were starting and what we are building is something radically different, but it's an echo of the best of what's going on in prisons across this country. And, you know, we have really great partners with the men and women who work in the Department of Corrections. And it really is an echo of the best that's being done, not the worst that's being done. Just like I want my life to be an echo of the best that was possible for people who have been sent to prison. And I don't want people to try to act like what I am and what we are is just another rendition of the worst of what we've ever done.
Did you pick the 500 books that are in that library?
I guess I need to take responsibility for that.
That's an interesting way to answer the question.
I didn't pick it by myself. You know, it's books that I love, but it's books that I haven't read, like Science Preceding the End of the World by Yuri Herrera. But you also have stuff that's like fantastic, that books that gobsmacked me. Andre Agassi's memoir, Open, is something that I didn't expect to be as good as it actually is. And you have classics like The Count of Monte Cristo. You have John Edgar Wideman. You have James Baldwin. But you also have Faulkner. You have the Iliad. I mean, you really do have a gambit. You have about 15 to 16% of the books that's in Spanish. And what happens is it is a world-opening library, we like to believe. And we curated it with the help of a lot of other people, with the help of a lot of conversations. But ultimately, I will claim the responsibility and the blame for what's missing.
The reason that I ask you were last on the show in 2019 when your collection Felon was published, your collection of poems, and you told us about being in solitary confinement. It was a place where you couldn't request books. Eventually, you received, somebody gave you a book called The Black Poets by Dudley Randall, and that you wrote your first poem later that same night, which is really striking as to the power of what that book did for you. We asked you if you'd bring a sample of your poetry. You actually picked a poem from Felon from 2019 called Blood History. We'd love our listeners to get a sense of your poetry. Do you mind reading an excerpt from that poem for us?
Yes, no problem. Blood History. In a cell we shared, Juvie asked if I'd long for a father. Had he said wanted, I would have dismissed him in a way youngins dismiss it all. A shrug, sarcasm, a sharp jab to the stomach, laughter. But he said longing, and in a different place, I might have wept.
The book, A Book, began your journey to that poetry. What do you imagine these microlibraries will begin for the people who will access them?
You know what's wild? So I come into the cell, right? And you never know what you expect when you get into a prison. And prisons always feel foreboding just because of the sorrow that is buried inside of a prison. And so you go onto the campus and it does feel foreboding, but that day it felt particularly hopeful despite that, but I was still nervous. And I walk into the cell and some guy that was incarcerated painted a mural. And the mural had this young black kid sitting down on what looked like clouds or the sky. And he had a book in his hand. And from the book, other books sort of flew out. And the other books were like these books with wings on them. And the kid was leaning up against Black Poets by Dudley Randall. Now, I know that the guy in the mural was me, but I don't fully understand how the person inside knew the story. And I think what we hope this project creates is a different kind of mythology, a different kind of history, a different kind of way to think about what's possible. I went to prison when I was 16, and in 8.5 years, the only people who told me that I could be a writer, a poet, a teacher, were mostly people I was incarcerated with, and some COs and some staff. And it was really still few and far between where I got those messages from. I think that this library, hopefully these freedom libraries, create a center of possibility in a way in which we can name people like me, people like Susan Burton, people like Mitchell Jackson, people like Randall Horton, people like Natalie Diaz, people like John Edgar Wideman. I mean, you have a whole country of writers who have been touched by incarceration because, you know, quiet is kept. This is not a Black problem. This is not a white problem. It's not a Latino problem. This is a fundamentally American problem. And I believe that the Freedom Library gives us a gateway for people on the inside and the outside to contemplate it with a new lens.
You want to build 1,000 of these libraries, these micro libraries. You have a $5.25 million grant from the Mellon Foundation. You have funding that comes with the MacArthur Fellowship, also known as a Genius Grant. Do you have what you need to make that vision happen?
Yeah, I wish. We're a bit of a long way off. Each Freedom Library costs roughly $25,000. That covers the purchase of the wood, that covers the purchase of the books, that covers the purchase of the labor that produces it. And so we're a bit of a ways off, but we're pushing. So our ultimate goal, and also we have a lot of attended programming because you don't want to just drop books off in sales. And so we have a lot of attended programming. We bring writers into the prisons. We actually create book circles on a constant basis, sending books in the juvenile detention centers. And while 1,000 is the start, we have more than 6,000 institutions of incarceration in the country. And so 1,000 is the start. 1,000 is how we prove that we care. But the reality is that there's a bridge to get to 1,000. Right now, we raised more than $5 million, and we've shown that it's possible, and we're doing it. And ultimately, we'll need to raise another $25 million to bridge the gap between building one and building 1,000. And I should say that when we build one in a prison, it's not just for the people who are incarcerated, it's also for the staff too. This is not a project that's singly about those doing time. We build the same kind of library in a space that's open for the staff with the same exact books, because anybody who has to serve a minute in prison should have an opportunity to experience beauty.
That's Reginald Dwayne Betts, poet, founder and director of Freedom Reads, and a 2021 MacArthur Genius Grant recipient. We hope to make you a friend of the show. Thanks for joining us today. It's great to hear about your work. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. We've really had fun talking with you today about libraries and books. Thanks for your calls and your shout-outs in social media. That is the show. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick and Amanda Beeland. We had help today from Francisca Monahan, Sarah Leeson, and Matt Ledden. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Karen Schiffman is our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow. It'll be Friday, and it'll be Radio Boston's Week in Review.